Sunday with Miriam on RTE Radio 1 with It's for Women. The car insurance with extra benefits like personal accident cover.
Turn of high tide and the stars coming out like primroses in the sky.
That's Lighthouse Stories with Luke Clancy this evening at 7 on RTE Radio 1.
On the way soon, Sunday with Miriam, when Miriam's guest is Pat Hume, who'll be speaking about life with her husband, John Hume. That's Sunday with Miriam after the news.
RTÉ News on Radio 1 at 10 o'clock with Sharon Tobin. Good morning. President Obama has said he will attend world climate talks in Paris at the end of this month, despite the deadly attacks carried out in the city last weekend. In a speech delivered in Malaysia following the Asia-Pacific summit, Mr. Obama also urged other leaders to attend and show they were not afraid of extremists.
We will not accept the idea that terrorist assaults on restaurants and theaters and hotels are the new normal, or that we are powerless to stop them. After all, that's precisely what terrorists like ISIL want, because ultimately that's the only way that they can win. It's the nature of terrorism. They can't beat us on the battlefield, so they try to terrorize us into being afraid.
Security officials in Belgium have decided to keep the metro public transport system in Brussels closed for at least part of today until they have reviewed the threat of an attack at a meeting this afternoon. The metro was shut yesterday after the government raised the threat alert to the highest level. Bars, restaurants and tourist attractions also remain closed today. It's believed one of the people behind the Paris attacks, Salah Abdeslam, is now in Belgium. The number of people killed in a landslide in a jade mining area in Myanmar, also known as Burma, has risen to at least 90. Dozens are still missing as a vast heap of waste material, discarded by mining companies, collapsed in northern Kitchen State. Officials said rescue workers were continuing to find bodies. Local people said many of the dead had lived on or near the waste dumps, scavenging for fragments of jade to sell. An estimated 100 people are still missing.
RTE Radio 1 weather with ESB Networks.
Stay safe. Never touch fallen or damaged electricity wires. For emergencies, 1850 372 999.
Today will be cold with sunny spells. There will be showers in the morning, but it'll be dry in the afternoon. Highest temperatures will range from 6 to 9 degrees. It'll turn very cold soon after dark, with air temperatures falling below freezing as early as 9 o'clock this evening in some areas. That's all for now. News and weather again at 11 o'clock.
Sunday with Miriam on RTÉ Radio 1, sponsored by Pamela Scott. Introducing The Collection. Stylish, classic, contemporary. PamelaScott.com.
Hello there and good morning. Today, a new book is published to celebrate the life and achievements of Nobel Peace Prize winner and one of Ireland's greatest ever political leaders, John Hume. I'll be speaking to his wife, Pat Hume. Also, we'll have live music from soprano Cara O'Sullivan and a special recording from St. Patrick's Cathedral in Dublin at last Friday night's Concert for Paris. Or email Miriam at rt.ie. You can find me on Twitter at Miriam O'Callaghan. You can listen back to our show at rt.ie/Miriam. Well, my music guest this morning is the soprano described by the Irish Times as the Irish superstar of her generation. Her amazing voice has brought her all over the world, performing in almost every prestigious venue you can think of. The Sydney Opera House, the Royal Albert Hall, the Barbican, the list goes on. But Cara O'Sullivan is very far from the stiff formality that many still associate with the opera world. She seems just as comfortable performing in the middle of Thomond Park before Munster matches as she does on stage. Cara, good morning.
Good morning, Miriam.
What was your initial view of the opera world? I mean, I think initially you thought it was a bit sexist, didn't you?
Yes. I do recall being in a chorus in an opera years ago. I was singing in the chorus and I remember this old, dirty, miserable tenor. I mean, the man couldn't sing his way out of a wet paper bag. And he clung me up against the back wall of the opera house. And I was horrified. I was young. I hadn't done the rounds, as it were. And I was very, very upset by the way he sort of grabbed me. I mean, if he did it to me now, I'd cut the hands off him. Well, I might cut more. But, you know, that time I was young and I was innocent, genuinely very innocent. And I hadn't a clue about that side of the business. And in truth, I have never encountered through the years, generally speaking, I have never encountered anything that I felt was untoward because I never allowed it to happen. I went home as soon as I was finished. Like most of my peers in my business, we go home. We go home to our families and, you know, go out and have a few drinks with friends and that. But this whole idea of, you know, party heaven, that doesn't actually exist anymore.
The nice thing about you as well, though, Cara, is you had your daughter, Christine, when you were very young in your early 20s. You were unmarried and that could have been difficult, but it never stopped you in your tracks at all.
Well, I think the primary reason for that would have been the support of my parents, and I would have been completely and utterly lost without them, both of them. And in more recent times before Mammy died, I mean, she was just incredible. She was so good to my daughter. I really feel I owe them an enormous debt of gratitude and thanks for all they did for me. I could never repay them for what they did for me. They just supported me. They helped me. They let me get on. My mother was a great woman. Now, get on with it. I'll call you if there's a problem. In the meantime, get on with it. And I did.
So in other words, she wanted you to be successful, to keep it your career. And then she took over a lot of the minding of Christine.
She took care of her. I lived with her. And when the minute I was finished, I used to just literally whiz down the M4, whether it be in Wales or London, heading on the boat back to Ireland and trying to get that 2 a.m. boat. And I used to be like, I got to know every pothole on the M4.
There were a lot, probably.
Believe me, I was able to duck them because I knew where they were. I was back and forth across the M4 so many times over the years. Not in recent years now, but I whizzed home. The very second I was finished, I whizzed home just to get home. So I was home maybe at 11 o'clock the following day, at home to look after things and help with whatever had to be done. That was my life. And how lucky was I?
And do you think, in a sense, when you had a baby very young in your early 20s, that it gave you a drive to be successful, that you had this new little person in the world that really relied on you and needed your support?
I think my overriding feeling at the time was just about a second chance and the opportunities that came my way. My teacher, Bobby, was so good to me. The NSO, the concert orchestra. I remember Simon Taylor would have been the manager of the concert orchestra around that time. And he was just so good to me and so kind. I know Simon is big cheese now inside in the National Concert Hall, but I do recall Simon being very kind and providing me with a lot of work. And I remember, you know, Colman Pearce was the conductor that time, all those years ago. And it was just, for me, it was so exciting to get to perform for the first time, live on television. I was absolutely, I mean, I remember Mike Murphy, I think, was the presenter, and he nearly had to kick me out the door to sing. And once I got out there, I just got on with it and won it. But it was an amazing experience. And these people along the way have been so quietly, so good to me.
And when you say won it, you're talking about the Young Musician of the Year. Mm-hmm. Was that your major break, Cara?
Yes. Yeah. It was 25 years ago, last February, imagine.
Your real professional debut was when you were 34 with the Welsh National Opera in Mozart's Don Giovanni. But a trip to the beautician beforehand, that led to quite a worrying time in your life, didn't it?
It was a strange moment. I was watching my weight and I had dropped some weight and I was looking after myself and I was feeling very good. And for the first time ever, I said, I'll get my legs waxed. I never got my legs waxed before. And I went in and I said, isn't that terrible? That cellulite that's up the back of my leg, the side and back of my thigh, isn't it terrible? And she said, if you don't mind my saying, she said, that's not cellulite. I know cellulite, she said. It's my job to know cellulite. That's not cellulite. Maybe you should go to your GP with that. I went to my GP and my GP referred me to a surgeon and he thought it was just a fatty lump. And we scheduled mid to late July to get it taken out. There was no biopsy done. He didn't believe that it was anything else except a fatty lump. Got it taken out and I was kept in for a few days and I got home and he rang me when I got home to say that it was cancer. It was a cancerous tumour.
So first of all, how shocking was that moment? And secondly, did you have to have treatments?
Mm-hmm. Well, it was shocking, obviously. I think it was stage 2 cancer. It wasn't very high grade. But I remember Mammy being there with me in the kitchen at home. And it's only afterwards I realised it was such a shock to her. She never actually got up from the chair for something like 10 hours. She never got up off the chair. And it was only a few days later she admitted to me that she got such a fright. Sure. She couldn't get up off. She never even to go to the lavatory or anything. She just didn't go. She didn't move. She sat in the chair for hours and hours and hours. And I, you know, it's like anybody that has been affected by this awful business that is cancer. Most of the time they just kind of get on, do their best, have a bit of a cry about it, have a scream about it, maybe even like I did, but then just get on with things. But it's the family that is, it's the impact that it has can be dreadful. I went and had, I was went to this radiologist and he said, 3 weeks after the day you get your treatment. And I said, no. I said, I'm not going for any treatment. I'll have it when I come back. I'm going to Welsh, making my debut in Welsh National Opera. I'm not going to have any, I'll have the treatment when I come back in December, because this is August. This is the first opportunity I have had. I am not letting this go for anything or anybody. And I'm in business. And he wasn't having it. So he said, leave it with me. He said, I met this chap at a junket. And he's based in the Cardiff Hospital, Cancer Hospital, Velindra it's called. I'll call him and see if he'll fit you in. And they did. And every morning before rehearsals, I went to the Velindra Hospital and had my zap. I was very well looked after there and I got through it. I got home in December and that's sort of when sort of my spiritual legs kind of went out from under me when I got home in December. It took me several months to get over it.
What do you mean by your spiritual legs?
I kept singing. And I got home early December after a long tour, an amazing experience. And I got home. And then when I actually realized that I could actually just stop, that's when I think my two legs sort of went out from under me and I just dropped, went down like a stone. But I suppose it was just I had to learn and find a way of coping and talking to people that helped me cope. And then the other thing I lost the ability was to sleep at that time. That was a huge problem. I wasn't sleeping very well.
You spoke about your parents earlier in the interview and also how wonderful your mother was. But I know for you, because of her role, even in helping to bring up your daughter, when she did leave this world, you found that very difficult, didn't you? Mm.
I was with her through thick and thin and when she had cancer herself. And she lived until she couldn't live anymore. And about 3 weeks before she passed away, she kind of gave up the ghost. And we, as her children and I, helped her on her journey. And she had the most beautiful, peaceful passing. And I recall a great friend who is a nurse manager. He said to me, when the time comes, tell her it's okay to go. And I think it is the most beautiful advice you can give someone when you know someone and they have someone belonging to them that's on their way. And to tell them it's okay to go. As upsetting as it may sound, it is actually a wonderful thing. And my mother, after I told her, no, Mammy, it's time to go. We love you. We'll miss you. But Daddy's waiting and it's time to go. And she did about 15 minutes later. And I will never, as long as I live, I will never forget it. And on the few occasions that I know someone that has someone belonging to them that is on their journey to the end of their life. And I have quietly said, tell them it's okay to go.
Your daughter, Christy, now, do you still live together? You used to live together.
She recently moved into her own home with her young man. And I'm delighted for her. I have a bit of an empty nest syndrome because she took my doggies as well. So I miss my child and I miss my dogs so much. But I can't look after them when I'm on the move, you know. And so she has them. She has my doggies and she's gone. And I'm thrilled for her and I'm so happy for her. And I'm sad at the same time, naturally.
Now, the lovely thing is this morning is you're going to sing live for us because you're going to be performing two Christmas gala concerts with the RT National Symphony Orchestra on December the 17th at the National Concert Hall here in Dublin. What's the piece of music? I think it's from Romeo and Juliet you're going to be.
That's correct. I know that aria a long time. It's Je veux vivre. And it's, bear in mind now, Juliet is only 14. So I have to kind of pretend a small bit, you know. It is a while since I saw 14. I think the last time I saw was on a bus. But but it is a pretty lovely aria written by Charles Gounod. And I love singing it. And it's fun to do. And it's before the madness descends on the Capuletti and Montecchi, as you know, the Romeo and Juliet story. Yeah. But before that, this is when she's happy.
OK, accompanied on piano now by Niall Kinsler. This is Cara O'Sullivan singing Juliet's Waltz Song.
Oh. Sunday with Miriam on RTE Radio 1.
TV license inspector.
TV license inspectors call to almost 1,000 unlicensed homes and businesses every day. If you don't hold a valid TV license, they will be calling to you. This could result in prosecution and a court fine of up to €1,000. Avoid the penalty and pay on time at any post office, tvlicense.ie or low call 1890 228 528. It's the law. This message is brought to you by the Department of Communications, Energy and Natural Resources.
We all know strong, healthy bones need calcium. We all know yogurt is a great natural source of calcium. You might not know that your body needs vitamin D to absorb calcium. They work hand in hand. Not all yogurts contain vitamin D. Cal-In Plus from Yoplait does. In fact, all of the recommended daily amount in one portion. Cal-In Plus. Calcium plus vitamin D working hand in hand for strong bones.
What noise does the train make?
Choo choo.
What noise does Mummy and Daddy's car make?
Time for a new car? Nissan's €4,000 scrappage offer is back and better than ever. Trade in your old car with us and you'll get a guaranteed €4,000 towards a brand new Nissan. And now you can finance your Nissan from only €49 per week. No deposit required. Nissan. You'll never look back. Finance is made under a hire purchase agreement. Terms and conditions apply. Subject to lending criteria. See nissan.ie.
The Taxman is getting ready for tens of thousands of revenue audits and spot checks. In this week's Sunday Business Post, get your revenue audit survival guide with expert advice on how to protect you and your business. Plus, how Ireland's lawyers beat the government and the Troika. The Sunday Business Post, independent journalism on Sunday.
Today from 11 on RTE Radio 1.
Will you tell our listeners about how they stopped using the internet for communication?
When Al-Qaeda started to become under scrutiny of the mass of intelligence agencies, they stopped using sophisticated communications and they changed the way they used the internet. They would share the password for an email account and one man would go on to leave a message as a draft. Somebody else would check that email account and read the drafts. It was a simple way of exchanging information.
The Marion Finucan Show on RTE Radio 1 with Ireland's savings specialists. Rabodirect, the straight-talking savings bank.
Sunday with Miriam on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Pamela Scott. The red dress you've always wanted but couldn't find for Christmas is here at pamelascott.com.
Text 51551. Sunday with Miriam on RTE Radio 1.
Our email is miriam@rt.ie and you can find me on Twitter at Miriam O'Call. Well, he is considered one of the great political figures of the last half century in this country, and a new book has just been published by Four Courts Press about John Hume, civil rights leader, SDLP co-founder, Nobel Peace Prize winner.
As a Catholic, I must bluntly state that Catholics here are faced with blatant social injustice. In the form of gerrymander, in the form of discrimination.
We have a duty, those of us who believe in totally peaceful means, to use all our powers of persuasion with the people involved. And I'm doing that, and I apologise to nobody.
Today we can take a collective breath and begin to blow away the cobwebs of the past.
Well, this new book about John Hume isn't the first biography, but it is the first to contain a chapter by the woman who has shared her life with him for the past 55 years. Pat Hume is a remarkable woman in her own right. Pat, good morning.
Good morning, Miriam.
A lot of people listening might wonder why John himself isn't here to also talk about the book with you.
Well, unfortunately, John is having severe memory difficulties at the moment. He has a form of dementia. And this started in the late 90s. John was speaking at a conference and he became very, very seriously ill. He had a ruptured intestine, very, very severe septicemia set in. He was on a ventilator and all sorts of machinery. And the body was under severe stress. He had no reserves of strength left, and the hospital authorities thought he wouldn't make it. Something actually went wrong with the ventilator, and I think it was at that stage that he suffered some brain damage. This, down through the years, has got worse, and his memory is now very bad. It hasn't actually taken away all his quality of life, in that Derry is a very dementia-friendly city. People love John. He can go out for a walk. Every taxi in the place will stop for him, you know. And so he's extremely lucky in that way. I can go for a walk myself. He can do his crosswords. He can read, you know, enjoy the paper. Mm. So it could be worse.
And when you say he has memory loss, how bad is his memory?
Very bad, Miriam. If John was speaking to you now and I said to him in half an hour, it was lovely to see Miriam, he would say, where did we see Miriam? He just wouldn't know that he had seen you. If he was out for a meal, you know, he would be back for half an hour and I would say, it was lovely food we had tonight. And he would say, what food? Mm. So it really is very sad.
Interestingly, we had Mary Kenny, the journalist, on recently, and she was talking about her late husband and how for the last, you know, maybe decade or more of his life, she was caring for him. Mm-hmm. And that although she adored him, mm-hmm. it is a tough role in life sometimes.
It can be very tough, especially at the end of the day. And, you know, when somebody asks you the same question 20 times and you're given the same answers, and it's very hard to sort of get up the energy to, you know, be pleasant. And so it can be tough. I am very blessed in that I have a daughter in Derry who's a doctor, and she keeps a very good eye to him, and she, you know, it's great having her there.
Because the lovely thing would be, if he was well enough, he would be able to, I suppose, speak at this book launch next week, the new book. But he's not in a position to do that. Sure he isn't, really.
No. He'll go to the Derry launch. He actually, for a man who travelled the world non-stop, he doesn't like being away from home now. He loves Derry. He loves going down to Donegal because they're very familiar to him. He doesn't like going to Dublin. If he goes to Dublin, he'll say, right, we go home now, you know. And John loved Dublin and he loved Europe and he loved America. Now he's not interested. Amazing.
Go right back. Where did you first meet John Hume?
I first met John Hume in 1958. I remember it well. It was the Easter holidays. I was in college in Belfast. And Easter's a lovely time. In those years, we always did very strict Lents. The end of Lent and the spring had arrived. And we used to go to Borderland, which was our local dance hall, about 3 miles away in Muff. And in those days, if you danced with somebody and it was followed by a lady's choice, it was only courteous to return the lady's choice. And then if he was a gentleman at all, he had to return the dance to you. So you ended up having 3 dances with the same person. So I had 3 dances with J.H. So then he said, may I see you home? And the poor fella didn't know that I lived at the end of the waterside. So you got the bus to Derry from Muff. And so he walked to the far end of the waterside. And then he had to walk to the far end of the Derry side, about 4 miles. So he must have been keen, you know, because he was back again. So that's kind of started the relationship. And during the course of that time, he told me he had been to Maynooth.
Because he was studying to be a priest.
He was studying to be a priest. He was in Maynooth. He had been scheduled to do his degree the previous year, but had ended up in hospital again with stomach inflammation and so on. He was there for 3 weeks, I think. Missed all his exams. But during that time in hospital, had time to wonder about his vocation. So he decided maybe any gifts that he had could be used better in other pursuits. And he decided to leave Maynooth, which wasn't an easy decision in those days. And then he did his degree that year. And he got a job then in teaching French and history. And he was full of the joys of teaching. He loved it. And he was a very good teacher. But during that time, the man was tireless. He had energy like which I had never seen. He and a group of wonderful people in Derry set up the first credit union in the north.
I think John was involved in the credit union setup because he used to see his own mother, didn't he, having to borrow from moneylenders.
Absolutely. The way it was done in Derry at that time was, you got a club from a shop. And there was a very good shop called Hills in the Waterside in Derry. So if you had a child, say, coming up for First Communion or you had Christmas was coming up, you got a £50 club. And then the Hills man called every Friday and you paid back at a certain rate of interest. And but you were totally restricted in where you could go. You couldn't ask for discount because you were, you know,
dependent on it.
So credit union which was the People's Bank. They were pulling their own savings. And then if they had to borrow, it was their own money and their neighbour's money that they were borrowing. And the fact that it was their neighbour's money that they were borrowing, there were very, very few delinquent loans. People were very conscious that they had to be paid back.
Well, you were a full-time school teacher as well when John was this busy. But you say you owe a lot to a woman called Molly Doherty, don't you? That you managed to do this even with having four children.
Yeah. Molly was a neighbour of John's. And when Trez was born in 1961, Molly's own family had been reared. And she said she would be delighted to come and to look after Trez. And then this was followed by Anya, and this was followed by Aidan, and this was followed by John. And it didn't matter to Molly. She just loved every one of them and minded them. And came every morning at 8:30 and stayed until 4 o'clock every day, and I came in from school.
The lovely thing is you've written a chapter in this book about John and that pivotal moment you write about when John led a march against internment in January 1972 on McGilligan Beach. It was close to the prison where some internees were being held. We've got a little bit of archive of that now. It's of an exchange on the beach that day between John and a British paratrooper who was preventing the march progressing along the beach. Now listen closely because it's hard to listen to it, but just listen.
Could you tell me on what authority that you're holding us back here from walking along
this
street?
Is a prohibited area. You're not allowed in a prohibited area, and it goes 3 miles
under
out to sea.
Under what law? Would you ask those men not to stop firing rubber bullets? Women, please.
They will not. They'll stop it, provided you keep away from the war and don't try to enter this prohibited area.
Yeah, but we want to march in there.
You're not allowed to march in here.
Why not? It doesn't belong to you. You can't prohibit it.
You've been hearing by your government.
Who's government?
The government of Northern Ireland.
Not our government. And that's why you're here, because it's not our government.
What do you remember about that time and about John at that time on McGilligan Beach?
I remember he came back that evening and he was really, really depressed. He said the paratroopers were intent on doing a lot of damage. And there was a march that was arranged for the Bogside the following day, from Craigan down to Bogside.
And that was, of course, Bloody Sunday.
And that was Bloody Sunday. And he was worried. I mean, what he felt was if they could be so dreadful on a beach where there was nothing to throw, it was a sandy beach, what were they going to do on the confined streets of the Bogside? So he talked to the Northern Ireland Civil Rights Association and he tried to dissuade them from having the march. But people were really, really emotional at that time. It was felt something had to be done. But he said, well, he wouldn't participate in the march. But the march went ahead and it was a huge march. And I remember we have a sitting room upstairs and it kind of overlooks the route of the march. And he sat in the sitting room upstairs and he said, I'm finished politically. He said, obviously, nobody listened to what I was saying. And the march continued on down to Free Derry Corner. And then we heard the shots. And a lot of shots. And a friend of mine, Kathleen Donaghy, a teacher, Kathleen came, she had been on the march and she came running to our house. And she talked about the number of people who had died. And then everybody started to come to the house. And as the day went on, young lads who hadn't come home, relatives started to come and asked John, could he go to the different interrogation centres around the city and go to the hospital? So John did what he could to find out who was being held in the different interrogation centres. He then went on to Alton Galvin Hospital and he was given a list of 12. And he came back home and he got the addresses and he went to the various homes. And there was one family, I remember, who stayed in our house and their young lad had not come home. And John said, well, look, they've assured me that's everybody. And then the phone rang and it was one of the doctors from the hospital. And he said, John, I'm really, really sorry. There is another casualty here. And John had to go down to the house and tell the mother that he was so, so sorry that his son was dead. God. And all the hotels closed, I remember, and the place was just, it was bleak weather. It was the end of January. The weather was bleak. The town was bleak. Everything was bleak. And all those funerals on the Wednesday morning, I remember Garrett Fitzgerald, Charlie Haughey, all the ministers coming from Dublin and going to the funeral. And it was after that then that there was a lot of violence before that, but after that the violence just escalated.
You mention in the book the horror you felt when you heard about the awful attack in the home of Austin Curry, obviously, a colleague of John's, and the letters UVF were cut into his wife's body. I mean, how did you cope as a family with the fear, I suppose, for yourself, for John, and for your children?
Well, you just coped, Miriam. I mean, one didn't have an alternative. The kids went to the local school. Their friends were all the children in the area. And we were just lucky to get through it.
But your house was firebombed in 1987, and I think graffiti was put on your wall. I mean, they were very difficult times, weren't they? When he was taking that chance and speaking to Gerry Adams.
Yeah, they were extremely difficult times. And I became very ill in 1987, and I think a lot of it was a gallbladder gone crazy, but I think a lot of it was just stress as well. It was at that stage that we decided we needed a treat, and it was the best decision we ever made. We got a house between Maville and Greencastle, just about half an hour from Derry. So it really was a retreat in that you could be there very quickly in a totally different world. Mm. And I think that was our sanity for the next 10 years.
Because when John's talks with Gerry Adams did become public, you know, he came in, as I said, for huge criticism from all quarters. We've got a clip of him now, actually, being interviewed on RT by the late, great Brian Farrell.
This is 1988, and there's been a lot of calls. The year opened with everybody who was eminent in sight calling for dialogue.
What's the point of dialogue?
Brian, would you let me answer your question?
What about this point, though? You have said repeatedly that you will not speak to people who are ambiguous on violence.
I did not say that. I have said repeatedly that I will speak to anyone if I believe that talking to them will make a contribution to peace and stability on our island.
Is it the case that you spoke...
And I hope that this dialogue will lead to just that. But I wouldn't wish to raise anybody's expectation. And I'm going to explore every avenue that yesterday's talks opened up for me.
And what about the argument?
I will speak to anyone.
People would now...
I will speak to anyone.
Sure, you've said that several times.
In the book, Pat, you write that John lost a lot of weight, his sleep was fitful and he was deeply exhausted. All of this time, it must have been really difficult for you all. Was there a moment where you said to him, John, stop this? Stop talking to him.
Funny, I remember it well. And I remember it was the Shankill bomb had taken place in October 1993. And I mean, the threats from loyalists were coming fast and furious. And not threats from our own party members, but exhortations, please stop. Just people worried about John's health because they could see that he was very failed. But on the Thursday of the funeral of young Begley, who had thrown the bomb, and Gerry Adams was carrying the coffin, I thought, there's something wrong here. You know, these talks must stop. Now, I knew John could see a big picture that I couldn't see. But that was probably the one time I thought it has to stop. And then on that Saturday, John was scheduled to speak to a group of doctors in London. So I went with him. And we came back from the conference, had a bite to eat and went on up and put on the television. And at about 11:30, breaking news came through about Grey Steel.
Seven people were killed in a UFF gun attack on a pub in the County Derry village of Grey Steel.
Two men came in and said, trick or treat, then sprayed the whole place with bullets. There's bodies lying on the floor, covered with sheets.
I just couldn't believe it. I remember the following morning, which would have been the 1st of November, we went to Mass on the Kensington Road, and the gospel of the Mass was the eight Beatitudes, you know, blessed are the peacemakers. And I just thought, well, we have to keep going. We have to keep going. And as we come back, there was a billboard outside one of the newsagents, and apparently 50 businessmen in Belfast had come out and said, you know, peace must come. These peace talks must be supported. And that was the first chink of light that had come through, really. And from then, it started to get easier. And then at the Grey Steel funerals, when John, just in total exhaustion, broke down talking to one of the girls, and she talked about, the, you know, how prayers had been said the night before, that he would have the strength to continue with the talks, that it was so important. It was the only hope. Everything else had been exhausted, and that was the only hope. And then things began to improve. But for 6 months, I had lost weight, John had lost weight. We were just exhausted.
But when that woman came up to John in the graveyard, because, you know, I was there and everyone has seen that footage, and he was upset and he was crying, and those words of comfort to him, that meant a lot to him at that moment, didn't it?
Oh, absolutely. That meant everything to him. Mm. And I suppose, you know, we all have doubts. Mm. And that kind of gave him the strength then to go on. Yeah, and to keep going.
How wonderful was the day of the Good Friday Agreement?
That was superb. That was a happy ending. And, you know, I thought of the years and the wonderful, wonderful, generous people from the SDLP who in the 70s, politics wasn't popular in the 70s. You know, and I thought of these people sitting in booths, taking all the slings and, you know, stones and everything else that accompanied SDLP and non-violence and everything else. And it was just such, for them, I felt, such a justification of all the efforts that they had made down through the years, you know.
Many people have said down the years, though, to me, and I know it's said in many quarters, that obviously John Hume was the peacemaker, but that without you, seriously, being behind him, he wouldn't have been able to do it.
Well, I suppose I kept the boat afloat, as we all do. Mm. And I suppose I was there with an ear when he came back in the evening exhausted. And for me, it was a very enriching time. And the kids say the same thing, you know, that they were so enriched with. The house just never stopped. They talk about it now, and they talk about, again, how amazing it was to have this variety of people through the house, you know.
We spoke at the beginning about John's memory being so bad, and that's why he's not speaking to me here today. But is there a part of you, Pat, that feels quite sad that I suppose you two should now be enjoying your lives after all the hard work, after all that was achieved, that you should be able to be living a great life with John, but you can't because he's not well?
That's very true. And there are times that you do feel that. But, you know, in so many ways, I am blessed. Anya, my daughter, she will come every so often and she'll say, right, Mum, 3 days are booked. And her children are at the stage now where they're doing their Erasmus years I had 3 days in Bilbao, I had 3 days in Valencia, I had 3 days in Girona, I had 3 days. Great. So I am so lucky, really. And I have great friends, you know, and we'll go out for lunch once a month and I can lift the phone at any time. I can moan, I can laugh, I can, you know. So, you know, I'm very rich, really.
And what's nice is, because as you say, you're all very protected in Derry and John is loved in Derry and protected. Mm. But there may be people listening this morning in the other parts of Ireland who weren't aware, maybe, that John wasn't that well.
Yeah, that's possible. One of the things that I think has come from John's illness is the knowledge of dementia and different forms of dementia. And one of the things that I would love to see, it has started in some parts of the North, is a greater knowledge of being dementia friendly. Dementia-friendly workplaces, dementia-friendly factories, dementia-friendly cities, because it is getting very common and it must be really, really sad for the individual because you lose your uniqueness, you lose so much, and it would be wonderful if out of, say, somebody like John, who is a fairly prominent person, it would lead people to consider, let's make our area a dementia-friendly area, you know. Mm. And then when people say are out for a meal and they might say something which is inappropriate, because the filter does go in the brain, that you can shrug your shoulders and sort of say, oh, you know, that's it would be wonderful, really, if something like that could happen.
That's very interesting because there are so many people in the same position, I suppose, as you and John.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's quite scary when you look at the statistics and you look at the future statistics, which are even worse. I don't know what we're doing wrong in this world, but they are quite frightening.
You have a great faith, don't you? Do you find that spirituality, religion, prayer, that is a great strength for you?
I feel very strongly in the power of prayer. Now, I'm not a great prayer. down through the years, it was, you know, coming home from work, stopping at the chapel, running in, hello, I'm here. I hope you're with me. Don't forget me. And to you. And, you know, and I say that to my grandchildren, who are, you know, the older ones, not quite so gospel greedy. And I say to them, you know, just if you're passing a church and you have 5 minutes, just nip in, say, I'm here. And if things are going really well, say, thank you. I really appreciate. And if things aren't going too well, where are you? Help me.
You have a great positive outlook to life. I've been lucky to meet you a lot down the years. You're always in the same positive mood. How do you do that?
I don't know. I think I was the youngest of 6 by 10 years. And so I grew up without any kind of rules or regulations because both my parents were distraught, I think, when they heard that another bambino was coming into the house. And so maybe that's what, you know, I don't get uptight too easily, for which I'm very grateful.
Well, Pat, I'm delighted you spoke to me today because many of us knew down the years that behind John Hume and for all his greatness was Pat Hume. So it's been my privilege to talk to you today.
Many, many thanks, Miriam. Always a pleasure.
And that new book in which you have a chapter, and there's lots of other great chapters, it's called John Hume, Irish Peacemaker. It's edited by Sean Farron and Dennis Haughey, and it's published by Four Courts Press.
Sunday with Miriam on RTE Radio 1.
A lie told often enough becomes the truth.
Drama on 1, Sundays at 8 p.m.
An optimist sees the opportunity in every difficulty.
The tongue, like a sharp knife, kills without drawing blood.
I'm Stanley Townsend.
I'm Angeline Ball.
Hi, I'm Stephen Ray.
Hi, I'm Saoirse Ronan.
Hi, I'm Brendan Gleeson, and you can hear me at rte.ie/drama on 1.
On RTE Radio 1.
Hello, I'm Trina Horrigan, and I suffered from heel spurs and plantar fasciitis for years. Even after surgery, my feet were too sore to walk any distance. I went to Foot Solutions, and they fitted me with customised arch supports and a great pair of runners. The results are unbelievable. Now I walk to work and can stay on my feet all day. The visit to Foot Solutions has made a huge difference to my life. I can't recommend them highly enough.
Visit Foot Solutions in Dublin, Cork, Waterford, Limerick, Galway and Newbridge, or visit footsolutions.ie.
What's a smart gift to give your loved ones this Christmas? You could wrap up the usual array of novelty socks, selection boxes and jumpers. Or go to AerLingus.com and buy amazing value flights from just $19.99 one way including taxes and charges. They get to go somewhere great. You get all the glory. It's a no-brainer. Smart gives them something they really want this Christmas. Smart flies Aer Lingus. Book now at AerLingus.com. Offer subject to conditions and availability.
Love your music? Then tune into Roberts Radio, the perfect gift for Christmas. Enjoy the iconic styling of the legendary Roberts Revival. Tune over 15,000 stations on our internet radios or stream music wirelessly from your smartphone with our new Bluetooth range. And of course, with Roberts, you get supreme audio performance as standard. If you're looking for the ideal gift, then tune into Roberts this Christmas. Roberts, so much more than radio. Available now at Sound Store and leading electrical retailers.
The Ray Darcy Show.
We have David Putnam in studio. In your early days, you worked with like Keith Moon. I couldn't believe it, because the Who were big in my family. My dad is a drummer, so he used to point to Keith Moon and say, he is just an amazing drummer, because he broke all the rules of drumming. Yeah, what was it?
He broke all the rules of living. He was mad as a hatter.
The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1 with the new 152 Volkswagen range. You get so much more with Volkswagen.
Sunday with Miriam on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Pamela Scott. It's Christmas party season and Pamela Scott has the perfect dress. PamelaScott.com.
Email miriam at rte.ie. Sunday with Miriam on RTE Radio 1.
Well, we've had an avalanche of reaction to Pat Hume's interview. I want to bring you some of it, actually. Evelyn McLaughlin says, Pat Hume, what an incredible lady. What an amazing attitude. Another says, one of the greatest statesmen that ever existed. Always admire John Hume greatly. His efforts cut as an exemplar to others. Pat is a wonderful lady who demonstrates her love in her life. Another one, great to hear the wonderful Pat Hume. We owe them so much for his courageous moral leadership. Richie Whelan says, Pat Hume, talking about her husband John, illustrates what an outstanding, pragmatic Irishman he has been to create peace. Another one, isn't it a good job Mr. Hume didn't listen or give in to the media who tried stopping him talking to Gerry Adams? James says, dementia is such a difficult thing to live with and to witness. My own mum sadly passed away last April, having been diagnosed with it. Paul in Cork says, Miriam, John Hume, a great humanitarian and a true statesman. Mary says, Miriam, I was in the Guildhall Square on the 5th of March 2013 for a public ceremony where Bill Clinton went to Derry to honour John's work for the peace process. Pat was always the wind beneath his wings, and I wish them both the very best. And just to say, Bill Clinton has written the foreword to this new book. Frank Connolly says, I had the privilege of meeting John and Pat Hume, our best leader in this or any generation. My best wishes to them both. Michael Duffy says, John Hume is one of the few people I would cross a room to shake hands with. He obviously had great support at home. John Sheridan says, you have to admire the honesty of Pat. Hume talking about John Hume's dementia, heartbreaking to listen to. Someone else says, how sad to hear that John Hume's dementia. Both he and Pat sacrificed so much so that myself and other Catholics, in fact everyone in the North, could have a better life. So grateful to them both. Our thoughts and prayers are with them. Another one says, Val says, wonderful to hear Pat Hume on the radio. I'd like to thank her and John for all they did for us. He and Seamus Mallon are my heroes of heroes. Pat is also a heroine in the background. Thank you, thank you, thank you, wonderful people. Brian Nolan says, this is a compelling interview at the moment with Pat Hume talking about John. Paul says, what a great humanitarian and a true statement he was. They go on and on and on. And last one, Jana Coyne, what a wonderful lady Pat Hume is, and I will second that. Listen, as I mentioned earlier at the beginning of the show, Cara O'Sullivan, who sang live for us so beautifully, is going to be performing two Christmas gala concerts with the RT National Symphony Orchestra on December the 17th at the National Concert Hall here in Dublin. And you can also
Catch Cara's One Woman Show at the Everyman Theatre in Cork on January the 28th, 29th and 30th. More details at everymancork.com. And we're going to end this morning with a very special piece of music, actually, that was recorded on Friday night at St. Patrick's Cathedral in Dublin, which was the venue for a concert for Paris in honour of the victims of last week's attacks. Over 200 Irish classical musicians performed, and the event was organised by composer John Doyle. And you can hear more recordings from that concert here on RT Radio 1 next Sunday night on the In Concert programme at 11 p.m. Well, that's it for this morning's show. Cara O'Hare was in sound, Alan Tourney produced. Thank you very much for listening. I'll be back at the same time next week. Until then, we're going out listening to P.A. Jesu from Fauré's Requiem, sung by Pierce Cullen, who was the lead chorister with the Palestrina Choir.
Sunday with Miriam on RTE Radio 1.
Sunday with Miriam on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Pamela Scott. Why not take another look at Pamela Scott? You never know, she might surprise you. PamelaScott.com.
This November, all baking tins, all living room throws, all boxed cookware sets are half price in Home Store and more. But better hurry, because when all the half price baking tins are gone, they're gone. And when all the half price living room throws are gone, they're gone too. And as for all the half price boxed cookware sets, when they're gone, they're definitely gone. All offers available online at homestoreandmore.ie, as well as in store at Home Store and More. Home Store and More is now open in the Newbridge Retail Park, Newbridge. Home Store and More. Believe what we say. More savings every day.
I'm Paul Mullen, MD of Mullen Farm Supplies. We've a simple business mantra. Success can't be measured in cows, especially when you're a pig farmer. We supply feed to both cow and pig farmers, but never too much to either sector. We would hate anyone to regard us as a business that took sides. Obviously, this has restricted our growth. Year on year, we've grown no bigger in the last 12 years. If we maintain that level of stagnation, I would consider it a huge success, one that can be measured in cows or pigs.
For something that does make business sense, try the SBCI. We're supporting agricultural loans at lower rates and longer-term repayments through partner institutions. SBCI. Small businesses, big plans.
11890. Directory inquiries. See 11890.ie.
The Sunday Independent. It's everything you want in a Sunday newspaper. As the world teeters on the brink of war, don't miss our special report on what Islamic State is, what they really want, and how they can be defeated. And George Hook, accused of racism this week, explains his controversial views on migrants. Some of Ireland's best-known faces reveal how they get some me time. Plus, stock up for Christmas at Mothercare and the Early Learning Centre with €10 off for every reader. The Sunday Independent. The complete read. Terms and conditions apply.
Email Miriam at rte.ie. Sunday with Miriam on RTE Radio 1.
After the news at 11 on FM, we'll be joining Marion Finucane and her guests. While at the moment on Longwave 252 and RTE Radio 1 Extra, Sunday Spirit and our Sunday morning religious services. And a reminder that RTE Digital Radio is available to listeners in the Greater Dublin area, in Limerick and in Cork. RTE Radio 1, the time now is 11 o'clock.
Radio 1 with Sharon Tobin. Good morning. President Obama has said he will attend world climate talks in Paris at the end of this month, despite the deadly attacks carried out on the city last weekend. In a speech delivered in Malaysia following the Asia-Pacific summit, Mr. Obama also urged other leaders to attend and show they were not afraid of extremists.
We will not accept the idea that terrorist assaults on restaurants and theaters and hotels are the new normal, or that we are powerless to stop them. After all, that's precisely what terrorists like ISIL want, because ultimately that's the only way that they can win. It's the nature of terrorism. They can't beat us on the battlefield, so they try to terrorize us into being afraid.
Security officials in Belgium have decided to keep the metro public transport system in Brussels closed for at least part of today until they have reviewed the threat of an attack at a meeting this afternoon. The metro was shut yesterday after the government raised the threat alert to the highest level. Bars, restaurants and tourist attractions also remain closed today. It's believed one of the people behind the Paris attacks, Salah Abdeslam, is now in Belgium. A number of people killed in a landslide in a jade mining area in Myanmar, also known as Burma, has risen to at least 90. Dozens are still missing as a vast heap of waste material, discarded by mining companies, collapsed in northern Kitchen State. Officials said rescue workers were continuing to find bodies. Local people said many of the dead had lived on or near the waste dumps, scavenging for fragments of jade to sell. An estimated 100 people are still missing.
RTE Radio 1 weather with ESB Networks.
Stay safe. Never touch fallen or damaged electricity wires. For emergencies, 1850 372 999.
Today will be cold with sunny spells. There'll be showers in the morning, but it'll be dry in the afternoon. Highest temperatures will range from 6 to 9 degrees. It'll turn very cold soon after dark, with air temperatures falling below freezing as early as 9 o'clock this evening in some areas. And that's all for the moment from the newsroom.
The Marion Finucane Show on RTE Radio 1 with Ireland's saving specialists. Rabodirect, the straight-talking savings bank.
Hello there, and a very good morning to you. And you're very welcome indeed to the programme this morning. And we'll start our heads today with the Sunday Times. Britain lays out war plan to bomb ISIS. And this is David Cameron trying to get approval to launch airstrikes. Bank inquiry doomed to fail, say TDs. Though I saw Kieran Lynch on last night. He's obviously trying to hold it together. We'll see what would happen. But there's an awful lot of suspicion around that it's not going to go anywhere.